Good afternoon. We are back on Vox Pop. It is 2:08. I'm Bob Barrett, in for Alan Shar, talk on Medical Monday. And in the studio this afternoon to discuss stroke symptoms and treatment are Dr. Alan Boulos and Dr. Colm Amery, both of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Alan Boulos is the chief of the Division of Neurosurgery, director of the Neurovascular Section, and associate professor of neurosurgery and radiology at Albany Med. He specializes in the surgical and endovascular management of cerebrovascular disorders of the brain and spine, including stroke and cerebral aneurysm. Dr. Boulos, welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Colm Amery is a stroke specialist who has advanced training and expertise in the treatment of acute stroke and the prevention of secondary stroke. He's also assistant professor of neurology at Albany Medical Center. Dr. Amery, welcome.
Thank you.
Both first-timers on Medical Monday here, too, right?
That's right.
Okay, let's break them in slowly, friends. Doctors, welcome and thank you. We want you to get your calls in early today because this is a very fascinating subject, at least to me. The number, again, is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. And I want to talk first about some of the obvious symptoms of stroke. Because stroke is one of those conditions where it really is, the sooner you recognize it's happening, possibly you could get in there and prevent some damage.
That's absolutely correct. So I think it's important first to say a stroke is the sudden onset of neurologic symptoms. It's usually limited to one side of the body. So if you should suddenly experience weakness on one side of the body, or a facial droop on one side, or loss of sensation on one side of the body, or many other types of symptoms, including loss of vision in one direction, or sudden loss of vision in one eye, or loss of balance. These are all possible symptoms of an acute stroke. And you're absolutely correct. The sooner you get into the hospital, the more chance we have to actually intervene in such a way that we can maybe reverse the symptoms of the stroke.
And the causes are just mechanically the cause of a stroke. It's a blood clot in the brain or a blockage of some kind?
Yeah, so the most common type is called ischemic stroke, and the brain is devised where there's multiple vessels that run from the heart into the brain, the carotid arteries in the front and the vertebral arteries in the back. And if one of those vessels gets blocked off by a clot, either inside the brain or just before the brain, that area of the brain suffers from losing the blood flow, and that's when the symptoms develop.
And the intervention, I'm sure various ways you can do it. You can do it chemically. You can go in there and get the clot. Is there any way that's preferable, or is it a case-by-case thing?
Well, it's really a case-by-case thing. The only treatment that is approved by the FDA for treatment of stroke is intravenous tPA, which is a clot buster. Mm. And that can be given up to 4.5 hours in specific cases, most of the time within 3 hours of symptom onset. So you can get that treatment in there. Beyond that, there are other treatments that we have. Dr. Boulos does.
Yeah, so in cases where there's a severe blockage, a large vessel that's blocked off, sometimes the tPA that we give through the IV is not enough to open that vessel. And there's been, over the last 10 years, a revolution in the technology to remove those blood clots. Mm-hmm. Most recently, the FDA approved last year, a clot retrieval device that's been very effective at removing these blood clots.
Is that like the corkscrew type device?
So the corkscrew type device is called the Mercy device. That was approved in 2005.
Okay.
Most recently, there's a device called Solitaire and Trevo, which are a different design that seem to be quicker at reopening these vessels with a lower risk associated with them.
Well, I could sit here and ask you questions all day, but we have other people who want to do that. So let's get to some calls right now. We're going to start off in Cohoes with Jim. Jim, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I cannot believe who your guests are. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
I have great respect for them. In February of 2007, I had an AVM, and I was treated at Albany Med. And everything went well. It's a difficult operation, but it all went well. Gradually, my cognitive functions, I would say over a period of 2 years, returned. I'm not as sharp as I was, but I'm sharper. However, in 2011, something happened with the vision in my left eye, and I am now seeking advice. I am going to a doctor, and I was placed, here's every now and then I lose a word, and this is definitely a function of my AVM, but, you know, I was put in the tube, and they do the scan of the brain, and what do you call that?
An MRI?
Yes, I had an MRI recently, just Friday, as a matter of fact, and my MRI is going to be reviewed by my ophthalmologist. So I guess my question to Dr. Boulos is, my vision was 20/20 in 2010. I had, as I had been advised to do, checked my peripheral vision all the time. I had it checked in 2007 after the stroke. It was good. I had it checked every 2 years when the union pays for my eye care. It's all good. But this year, in April of 2012, I noticed that when they give you the peripheral vision test, I was not clicking that little handle they give you. I knew something was wrong, and now, sure enough, I cannot read out of my left eye. If I have my prescription glasses on, I cannot read out of my left eye. So could this be related to the stroke of 2007? And will the MRI help the doctor understand why I cannot see out of my left eye?
Yeah, so vision is a complicated system. And sometimes you can have a stroke of the retina, which is part of the eye itself, and that can produce loss of vision, peripheral vision, or even central vision in that eye. Sometimes, however, it's actually an injury to the brain where the vision centers lie, and that will affect both eyes equally as you look towards the left. And so it gets confused by saying I can't see to the left because of my left eye, but it might be that both eyes can't see to the left, which makes reading more difficult. Most of the time, AVMs are located within the brain itself, and so when it does cause vision trouble, it usually will affect both eyes looking towards one side, and that would be peripheral vision usually. Definitely an MRI is very helpful in understanding whether the vision centers have been affected in the brain. If it looks normal, in other words, I understand there'll be an AVM that was seen there, and the consequences of its treatment will be seen on the MRI. But if the vision centers are okay, it can sometimes be a stroke within the eye itself that's happened. There are other causes for vision loss besides stroke, but that would be where you'd want to look at next, look at the flow to the retina itself. Sometimes if it's caught early enough, within 12 to 24 hours, treatment can be done to try to restore that vision with a drug that's given to open up that vessel.
Would it be is it something that could have, this far away from his original stroke, still be symptoms of that original stroke?
It can be. It would be unusual for those symptoms to be new that many years after the treatment. It's possible with radiation therapy sometimes you can get symptoms 2-3 years later that develop from the radiation effects. But from surgery or from an AVM itself, it's rare to get symptoms years down the road. Now, if there's still an AVM there, it can cause some neurologic symptoms after years.
Okay, Jim, good luck with your MRI.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to New Marlboro, Mass, and talk to Dan. Dan, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I first want to echo the previous caller's sentiments that you have two excellent experts on there. I can attest to their knowledge and expertise firsthand. In January of this year, I suffered a vertebral artery dissection after a chiropractic neck adjustment, and then a stroke ensued. And I just wanted to ask the doctors to comment on the relationship of chiropractic manipulations to stroke. Also, I would like them to comment on the age at which stroke can happen. I'm 39 years old, and I was actually misdiagnosed for a couple of days at multiple hospitals because the doctors didn't think that a stroke could happen to someone at my age. So I would just like to throw it out there for their thoughts.
Okay, Dan, thank you. Okay, chiropractic and stroke, what do you think?
Hi, Dan. Of course, I know who you are.
Hi. Thank you.
So Dan's case is a very important one, actually, and we do sometimes see stroke occur after chiropractic manipulation, specifically chiropractic manipulation of the neck. So within the cervical spine, there are spaces that the vertebral arteries, which do supply blood to the back of the brain, pass through in order to get up to the head. And in cases, and we don't know why it happens in some people versus others, that artery can be damaged in the process of manipulation and lead to what we call a dissection. And a dissection can lead to stroke, which is what happened in Dan's case. And there are very few studies that look at how common this is, how frequently it happens. But I do tell my patients to be careful about having chiropractic manipulation of their neck for that reason.
Mm.
To the second point that Dan mentioned, stroke knows no age limits. It can happen to anybody from birth through all the way up to age 100. We certainly see it much more frequently in people in their 60s and older, but especially in a place like Albany Medical Center, which is a referral center, we see a lot of patients with stroke who are younger than that. So again, if you have any symptoms that fit in with what I said at the beginning of the show, that is a reason to seek medical attention immediately.
It must be important to get that word out because people will get those symptoms but say, I'm 30, I can't be getting a stroke.
Exactly right, yeah.
Actually, there's been documentation or there's some reports that a large number of strokes that actually lead to death, because they happen in young people, no autopsy is done, and so the correlation to a stroke event is never made. They may have died in a car accident post an event like what I had or something like that. So the statistics really are very vague and have been manipulated dramatically for different results.
I would just add that a dissection is a tear in an artery, and it can be treated medically quite well, using either medical therapy or occasionally a procedure like a stent to repair the vessel. Mm-hmm. And both, preferably medicine over the stent, but both treatments really work very well to prevent further strokes.
All right. Dan, thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Sure. There's also a great website out there if people have questions about chiropractic relationship to strokes. It's neck911.com, and there's a lot of great links and studies and various things there.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Now you've got every chiropractor in the world calling me. I appreciate that. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of your calls. Get them in on Vox Pop. Support for WAMC comes from Paula Redmond Real Estate, with offices in Millbrook and Rhinebeck, featuring a variety of homes and property throughout Dutchess and Columbia counties. PaulaRedmond.com. Friends of Chamber Music presenting Cecilia String Quartet Saturday, November 17th at 8 p.m. in the Kiggins Hall at Emma Willard School in Troy, New York. 518-273-4843 for tickets. And Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, a Master's in Social Work program hosting an information session Tuesday, November 27th, 6 till 9 p.m., adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. And we are back on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. We're talking about stroke today with Dr. Alan Boulos, the chief of the Division of Neurosurgery and director of Neurovascular Section at Albany Medical Center, and Dr. Colm Amery, a stroke specialist who has advanced training and expertise in the treatment of stroke, acute stroke and prevention of secondary stroke at Albany Medical Center. And we've gotten some good conversation going already. Let's see what we can start up now with Rita in Rosendale. Rita, good afternoon.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. My mother-in-law, Erna, was just receiving exceptional care in your facility. And I have a question that I didn't manage to ask. In the case of subarachnoid hemorrhage, does a delay in starting treatment have a big effect on the ultimate outcome of treatment?
Hi. So,
hi, doctor.
Hi, how are you?
You guys have a lot of friends.
So in the beginning, we talked about stroke being a blood vessel that's blocked off from the inside. The other kind of stroke, which occurs about 10 to 15% of the time, is called hemorrhagic stroke, where there's actually a leakage from the vessel either into the brain causing something called intracerebral hemorrhage or around the brain causing subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is what the question is asking about. Usually the cause for subarachnoid hemorrhage, blood around the brain, is from an aneurysm in most cases, certainly not every case. And when it is from an aneurysm, a couple immediate consequences are potentially there. One is something called hydrocephalus. If fluid builds up as a result of the bleeding, then a life-saving procedure where you place a drain to evacuate that fluid can be life-saving, and time would then be of relevance. The good news is that aneurysms usually don't bleed for more than a few seconds. So a common misconception is the aneurysm continues to bleed. That's not the case. So we try to treat the aneurysm to prevent rebleeding as urgently as possible, but we have to do it in a safe manner. So that the treatment isn't necessarily emergency, where seconds matter, whereas treating the consequences of the bleeding can be an emergency.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess my question was, because she was treated in another hospital where they didn't relieve the pressure from the hydrocephaly, and she didn't receive that treatment until a day after the event in your facility. And I was just wondering if that day lag in treating that aspect of it will make a difference to her in her recovery.
Usually not. Usually, because I know her and she is making a good recovery, I don't think it did make a significant consequence. But certainly in other cases where someone slips into a coma, it may have made a difference.
Okay, Rita, thank you for your call.
All
appreciate
right.
it.
Thank you so much. You're wonderful. Bye.
1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. Let's go to Linda in Queensbury. Linda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I had a stroke or something when I was 28 years old. I'm 64 now. And what happened was I was balding on one side of my head. I lost feelings in my left arm and my left leg, and you could poke me with a needle and I couldn't feel it in the left arm and the left leg. But I didn't have any kind of palsy in my face. I don't remember having anything like that. But the after effects of all of that have been headaches from hell. I mean, headaches to the point where it is piercing. I just freeze because it's such a piercing. It's like somebody put something right in my brain, you know, like a big sharp needle or something. And I don't know. So here I am asking you, could that be hysterical paralysis, because I was going through a lot of trauma at the time? Could it be the result of the head injury I received from my ex-husband, or do you think it might have been a stroke?
Hi, Linda. It's Dr. Amory here.
Hi, Dad.
So, you know, I think you raised some very good points here. It's very difficult to tell at this point, you know, this many years down the road, exactly what happened to you back then. But a couple of things occurred to me. One is, I mean, certainly this could have been a stroke at the time. 40 or 30 some odd years ago, we didn't have the same kind of diagnostic tools that we have now to be able to see, you know, such as a MRI, whether or not a stroke occurred at the time. Another possibility is that this could have been migraineous. It could have been a migraine headache that caused these symptoms. And we see we see this a fair amount, where people have a migraine once in their life, particularly, that has associated symptoms that mimic a stroke. And the sensation that you had on loss of sensation you had on that left side could well be part of that. And, you know, that makes me think of that is the fact that you've been having such severe headaches since then in the years, you know, since that time. So that's certainly a possibility.
What about the balding? I mean, I was going like shiny bald in the on the left-hand side of my head, and the neurologist that I saw at the time said, your hair will not grow back, and it grew back.
Well, hair loss is absolutely a sign of stress. It's not usual that we see it only on one side of the head, but it's certainly a possibility, and you said you were undergoing a fair amount of stress at that time, which I understand.
Right, I was.
Yeah, so, you know, hard to tell for sure, but it sounds like that, you know, could add up altogether that way.
Okay.
Linda, thank you for calling. Oh, go ahead.
You're welcome.
Oh, go ahead.
What do I do about my migraines? I tried the Imitrex, and I was losing bladder control. And the doctor hasn't offered anything else. I haven't asked for anything else because I'm real hesitant to take medication because I already have issues. Why add medicines to that issue? Or why add chemicals to the issues that are already going on? So I did try the Imitrex, and that worked. I mean, it got rid of, I was headache-free, but I was losing my bladder.
Right. So there are other medications in the same class of medications as Imitrex, which you might tolerate better. Some more recent formulations which might work.
Okay. So I'll ask the doctor about that.
Okay. Sure. Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it.
What class of medications would I ask the doctor for?
Those are the triptan medications.
The triptan?
Yeah. Triptan.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. That's the number to call if you want to get in on the conversation. And if she didn't ask it again, I was going to ask about the balding because that on one side, it's very unusual.
Somehow I missed that when she said it, but yes, when she brought it to my attention, that is interesting and unusual.
But that would more be a stress thing more than a stroke thing.
I think so. Yeah, okay. We don't really see hair loss on one side of the head with stroke.
1-800-348-2551. Tiffany, with that, they hung up. They just had that question. See the question about there about small, what is small vessel disease? Is there treatment? Does that make sense to you?
It does.
Okay.
So small vessel disease is a result of the long-term effects of living with high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, or having smoked cigarettes for a long time. And what happens is the small blood vessels in the head are affected more than the large blood vessels. And what you get is changes on the MRI, you can see, which may not have, in the moment that they occur, a sudden change in neurologic function. So they wouldn't act as a stroke, but over time can accumulate and cause changes in your ability to function. So a lot of times when you get an MRI of the brain, they'll say, we see the effects of small vessel disease, which is a somewhat non-specific statement. It's just saying this person probably has these risk factors, has been living with them for a while, and we see the changes of them. It may be an indication that these are risk factors that need to be better managed.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Michael in Woodstock. Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just curious if there is any causal connection or correlation between a person who has multiple sclerosis and strokes.
So that's a very interesting question. Multiple sclerosis is a disease which is caused, as nearly as we can tell, by the body's own immune system attacking the coverings of nerve cells in the brain and in the spinal cord. It's an inflammatory disease, whereas stroke is a vascular disease, so it has much more to do with the blood vessels. We sometimes see people who have multiple sclerosis have strokes, or people who have strokes can develop multiple sclerosis. We don't know of a direct correlation between the two things at this point in time, so they really appear to be two separate illnesses.
Is a person who has MS, are they more prone to having strokes than someone who doesn't have it, or is it just simply something that can happen with equal frequency regardless of the existence of the underlying disease?
I would say that is correct, that it's really a separate issue, two separate disease processes that don't really affect each other.
Okay, Michael, thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. We are talking strokes today with Dr. Alan Boulos and Dr. Colm Amery of Albany Medical Center. 1-800-348-2551 on Medical Monday. Let's go to Poughkeepsie now and talk to Greg. Greg, good afternoon. Hello,
hi.
Greg.
How are you?
Okay.
I was wondering if stroke can be a trigger for Alzheimer's, or can bring it on quicker than it might have occurred otherwise.
So there is I don't think stroke goes on to cause Alzheimer's, but Multiple strokes can cause dementia, which will look a lot like Alzheimer's. And so there's a well-known condition called multi-infarct dementia, which basically relates back to that small vessel disease question. And so these tiny strokes that maybe when they occur don't cause symptoms, but the cumulative effect can cause memory loss and other things that look a lot like Alzheimer's disease. And so that's clearly a link in the sense that dementia and stroke are related. I would add to what Dr. Amory had mentioned before that the risk factor modification, getting those risk factors under control, increasingly has been understood to cause a reduction in strokes, even beyond what our surgical procedures. We had thought the surgical procedures were the best treatment for some of these disorders, but we're seeing that the addition of statins and other medical therapies have really revolutionized the prevention of secondary stroke.
And I would also just like to add that while Alzheimer's is not caused by stroke, there is a condition that is associated with Alzheimer's which can lead to bleeding in the brain, which is called amyloid angiopathy. And we do often see patients have intracerebral hemorrhages, that's bleeding within the tissue of the brain, that is associated with Alzheimer's disease. So it can, in the other direction, Alzheimer's can lead to hemorrhagic strokes.
Okay, Greg, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Now, you went and answered one of my questions I was going to come up with. I was wondering if the statin drugs might have an effect of, if not prevention, at least making it a little less likely or cleaning things out up there.
Yeah, the statin medications are really marvelous that way. We've found that because these are medications that were developed to lower cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And we've found that beyond their ability to lower cholesterol, they actually protect people against stroke. Particularly people who have had strokes before. Those are the ones that we've tested in large-scale studies. If you've had a stroke before and the LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, if that's above 100, we've found that being on a statin medication, irrespective of how much it lowers your cholesterol, appears to protect you against stroke.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. It's an all Greg day. Greg in Albany. Greg, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, doctors. So I currently take an oral anticoagulant to reduce my risk of a cardiometabolic stroke, but it doesn't eliminate my risk. So if I were to have a stroke and if I was brought to medical attention within a short time frame, within 3 hours, could I be given TPA?
That's a great question. Traditionally, we do not give TPA in that scenario because the blood is already thinned by the oral, by the pill that you're taking. Some patients fluctuate in the amount of, in how thin the blood is on that medicine. So when the blood isn't thin, certainly TPA is a good treatment, and it would always be checked right away to see if you were a candidate for the TPA. If the blood is too thin to give the additional TPA, then that's when we would try to do the interventional procedure to remove the clot using one of those devices I mentioned earlier, the Solitaire or Trevo device.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call, Greg. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a quick break now. We'll be back with more of your calls. We do have a couple of open lines, so get them in now. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back next on Vox Pop. Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Bard Center for Environmental Policy, a graduate school of Bard College, hosting an open house on Saturday, November 17th, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. with students and faculty, bard.edu/CEP. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts, ashokancenter.org. And One Roof Holistic Center, Saratoga Springs, New York, offering mindfulness, stress reduction programs for adults and adolescents, health insurance accepted, OneRoofSaratoga.com for schedule.
And we are back on Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Shar Talk today. The number, of course, 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. The subject today is stroke. Our doctors are Dr. Alan Bulos and Dr. Colm Amery, both of Albany Medical Center. And I say doctors, we've been getting some really good calls today, some really good questions, and a few more are up there, so let's get right to it. Let's talk to Ann in New Paltz. Ann, good afternoon.
Hi, I have a question about what happens when you get water on the brain and you have to have a shunt put in, and then there's a kind of free speech dementia type thing comes in, and it seemed to have been associated with TIAs, and I've never really heard the whole complex explained.
Okay, it's up to you.
I'm sorry, I don't know that I can fully explain it myself, but I can tell you water on the brain, or something called normal pressure hydrocephalus, where the ventricles are not necessarily very large, but the patient suffers from the features of water on the brain, and those features usually are balance difficulty and memory loss and urinary incontinence. And so shunting, a procedure where you divert that fluid to another space in the body, usually the belly, where the fluid is then absorbed, can be very effective at reducing the pressure, and the symptoms can get better. I guess I don't know enough about...
This was a shunt that was put in at the back of the head, and it was my father, and I always thought it was related to his tendency to have TIAs. I don't even know what led to it, but I was hoping your understanding of TIAs and strokes and so forth could explain that to me.
Well, certainly, when you have the need for a shunt to be put in, you can have neurologic complications from the shunt being put in, but I don't think there's typically a direct connection between having a shunt in and having TIAs.
No, it was the other way around. Having TIAs and the shunt was the relief.
Yeah, TIA is a brief stroke-like symptoms that last less than 24 hours. So if you develop weakness in the arm and it goes away within 30 minutes, that's considered a TIA. Typically, a shunt's not used for that, at least not the traditional shunt that I was referring to, where you divert fluid from the brain to the belly. So that's what's puzzling me, at least. But other symptoms, again, if you have memory difficulty, that can wax and wane. That can get better and get worse. And so the shunt might be used to improve symptoms like that.
Okay, Ann, I think that's the best we're going to get for you today.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. 1-800-348-2551. Before we go on, we're talking about TIAs a lot right here. Mm-hmm. Let's just get down to an explanation for folks who might not know it, just exactly what we're talking about when you say a TIA.
Sure. So a TIA, which stands for transient ischemic attack, is essentially the same thing as a stroke, except that it doesn't cause permanent damage. So you have loss of blood flow to a portion of the brain, but then that blood flow is restored and quickly enough that the brain doesn't suffer a full-out stroke. So, you know, we treat it exactly the same way as we treat a stroke. The only difference between the two is that in the one you have ongoing symptoms, in the TIA you don't. But it's still caused by exactly the same processes, and is as much, in my opinion, an emergency as a stroke is. Hmm. So, you know, my opinion is that if you have any time focal onset of symptoms like I described at the beginning of the show, even if they were to get better within 50 minutes or 30 minutes, it's still a reason to go to the emergency room and be evaluated for that.
Would waking up and having like a loss of memory for an hour or so, would that be something like that?
So there is a very interesting phenomenon called transient global amnesia, which is not a TIA, but which can be sometimes associated with stroke. And so that is another, I would say, good reason to go to the emergency room, but not the same thing.
Okay.
The big risk with TIA is you can have a stroke.
Right.
So it's kind of a warning sign. Mm. And so if you don't get treatment or get looked at to try and prevent, you may then have the full-blown stroke. So it's very important that that's assessed.
Okay.
Absolutely. And in fact, that risk is highest in the first day or two and in the first week after the TIA. So getting assessed quickly is of the essence.
And how would you assess that? Just with scanning or?
Well, we have a number of tests that we do for patients who have a transient ischemic attack. We look to see if we can figure out where it came from. And there are two main things that we look for. The first is if they have atherosclerosis, that's hardening of the arteries, within the carotid artery on the side where their symptoms would have originated from. And the reason we look for that is because that can be treated surgically. The other thing that we look for is if there is a source for a blood clot in the heart. And so we take a look at the heart with an echocardiogram, that's an ultrasound of the heart, as well as doing cardiac monitoring to see if we can pick up that arrhythmia that's called atrial fibrillation, which is a big risk factor for stroke. Mm. And those patients need to be treated with anticoagulation to prevent strokes in the future. So those are the two main things we're looking for when somebody comes into the hospital with a TIA.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Jay in Catskill. Jay, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Awesome.
Good. Thank you very much for taking my call. In 2000, 2001, I had cancer, and I went through chemo, and still in remission, you know, all these years later, which is great. In 2005, I had a small stroke, and the it was kind of a strange occurrence. What had happened was I woke up in the morning, and I went around doing my things, made coffee, fed the birds, and did all that, and I got a phone call. And when I went to answer the phone, I couldn't talk. I had no voice at all. I had no other neurological deficits, or, you know, I had no problem with my gait or walking or anything like that. I went to the hospital, and they did, you know, all the usual things, CAT scan, and they did a carotid ultrasound. And I ended up staying in the hospital, and they ended up doing a TEE, to determine whether, you know, I had something going on cardiac-wise. They found a small murmur, which was caused by, I guess, a small hole in between the chambers of the heart, which I understand is not entirely unusual. I recovered pretty quickly, but I did have aphasia where I was, you know, I had to search for words and sentence structures didn't get together, but I didn't have any kind of neurological deficit at all, just being lost for words and searching for another word in use of another one, you know, switching words out and stuff like that. And that got better, you know, pretty relatively quickly. And then in 2009, I had a vertigo attack, which just, you know, knocked me over. I mean, it was just, I mean, I've heard of vertigo before, but this was, you know, something like you would never, it was incredible. I just, I was seeing triple and double, and I never really, first of all, they called the stroke, they couldn't find a reason for it. They called it idiopathic, and it resulted, I guess it was somewhere between a TIA and a small stroke. It left a little bit of a scar tissue in the CAT scan, I guess, you know, something very small.
Jay, I don't mean to rush you, but can we get to the question, because we got a lot of calls?
Yeah. When you had mentioned the manipulation of the neck, each of the, in 2005, when I had the small stroke, I had hit my head in construction, and well, it didn't hurt my head, but my neck was always sore after that. And then in 2009, preceding that, I also had I was in a dentist chair for hours, you know, and my neck was really stiff. And for each time, whether it was coincidence or not, the manipulation of my neck, you know, just seemed to be in and around the events that happened. And I'm just wondering if you have a comment on that.
Well, I think, you know, of course, it's hard for us to tell at this point in time what might have caused these events that you had. Certainly the first one you talk about where you lost the ability to speak sounds like you had an event in the left side of your brain, which is the side of the brain where language lives.
That's correct.
And that's much less likely to have been due to any kind of neck manipulation, because that part of the brain gets its blood flow from an artery that doesn't go through those holes in the bones I was talking about before.
I see.
So unlikely. The second one, difficult to know. It sounds like you saw doctors and they weren't convinced that this was a stroke the second time. And in fact,
they diagnosed it as vertigo.
Yeah, and vertigo, which can be a symptom of stroke, is also can be a symptom just of a problem within the balance mechanism in the ear, and that can certainly just show up out of the blue, and you wouldn't need to have had any problem because of neck manipulation to cause that.
I see.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. We're going to go to Otha in Mount Adams.
North Adams.
North Adams. Okay. Well, okay.
That's all right. Hello, and Dr. Boulos perhaps doesn't remember me. He did surgery on me a few years ago after a second hemorrhagic stroke that I had, and operated on it and saved my life, and I'm so thankful. So I first want to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
But then I also have a question. Can you hear me well?
Yes, I can.
Okay. The question is, after that second stroke, and you operated on me, I've had no neurological or physical deficits, and I'm on the medication regularly. But my headaches are still there somewhat, not as bad as they were, but still sometimes they're there. And a neurologist that I've seen over here has suggested that I have a second surgery that is a heart fix, he calls it, to drill through my head to do surgery there instead of doing what you did, which was going to an artery in my thigh and then up to my brain. He said it was a soft fix. He really thinks that the next best thing to do is a hard fix. And I know, I'm sure you don't remember my case, but in general, do you have any notions about this advice?
I do remember you, actually. I think you bring up a lot of very important points. Patients who have hemorrhagic strokes, usually again from aneurysms, there are two ways to treat the aneurysm. One is through what we call an endovascular approach, which is through usually the thigh artery. And that's a less invasive approach that is used because the patients recover quicker. One of the downsides to that, though, is that it needs to be watched afterwards to make sure that there isn't a new aneurysm or reformation around the treatment of an aneurysm. The other method is surgery, where we make an operation through the skull and place a clamp or a clip on the aneurysm itself.
Right.
Even that has been found to not be 100%. Aneurysms can reform. It usually takes longer, 9 or 10 years after the treatment. My advice to you is to get the imaging redone and make sure that the aneurysm has not reformed. That would be the first treatment, because often there is no further treatment that's required, and that the headaches you suffer from, unfortunately, are a consequence of the bleeding episodes and not because you have an aneurysm that's treated. And so I would advise you to get imaging to make sure that the aneurysm is still well treated. If it's not, then either approach sometimes is used to treat it if there is reformation of the aneurysm.
Is there one that's better than the other, or is it a case-by-case thing, as opposed to what this man's other doctor was saying, the hard and the soft thing? Is there
No, I wouldn't use that terminology.
Yeah.
I do both procedures. There are risks and benefits to both methods, and it's a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Right. So a second question is then if there's time for you to answer, and that's... will I see any? Do you have any notion about whether or not I will see any long-term cognitive deficits from the headaches that I have, that are perhaps related to the aneurysm?
I don't think the headaches themselves will cause cognitive problems for you later on, except maybe to the point where pain affects your ability to concentrate. But it doesn't mean that the brain is being damaged. You know, the brain actually doesn't have pain fibers. So the headaches are not from the brain itself, but rather from the scalp and other and the covering of the brain called the dura. So I wouldn't be concerned about that, but we don't also want you living in pain and headaches. So, you know, there's some medicines that might be used to help that as well.
All right. We appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. Michael is in Preston Hollow. Michael, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Quick question. I've had a atrial fibrillation. I heard you mention this before, and I have a TEE, which was negative for a clot, and I had a cardioversion. And so I'm back in sinus rhythm. And they put me on Pradaxa, which I'm going to switch over to Coumadin at some point. But is there that much of a danger of developing a stroke from atrial fibrillation if you've had no prior clots? And is Coumadin or Pradaxa much better one way or the other? I understand the percentage of getting a stroke is like 2 or 3%, but the percentage of getting a hemorrhagic stroke from the medicine is like 1%, give or take.
So a great question. Atrial fibrillation, which is a very common arrhythmia of the heart, is a situation where the heart is not beating in an efficient way, and because of that, blood can pool in the heart and then form blood clots, which then can be sent up into the brain and cause stroke. The treatment to prevent stroke for people who have atrial fibrillation is with blood thinners like the ones you mentioned. The risk of having a stroke for any individual patient who has atrial fibrillation depends on a number of different things, including other risk factors that they have, high blood pressure, diabetes, if they've had a stroke in the past.
So, I had a TIA about 16, the shortest TIA in history, about 16 years ago, and I had a carotid endarterectomy by the eminent Dr. Shaw at Albany Med 16 years ago.
Sure.
With follow-up ultrasounds, which have been fairly benign.
That's great. You know, so that's one of the risk factors that does increase your risk, even if, you know, we never know for sure where a stroke comes from, whether it's because of the carotid artery or because of atrial fibrillation in that situation. But in my opinion, my feeling is that once you've had atrial fibrillation, you will always have atrial fibrillation, even if they're able to get you into sinus rhythm using cardioversion. So I feel, yes, it is important to be on anticoagulation with a medication to prevent stroke. So that's the first part of your question. The second part is complicated, which is the difference between Coumadin, which has been around for 60 years now. We've been using it to prevent stroke and to treat blood clots. And this newer medication called Pradaxa or Dabigatran, which has been approved for the prevention of stroke also. And they are both very effective at preventing stroke. At this point in time, I'm not using Dabigatran unless a patient can't take Coumadin for various reasons. Because if you were to have a bleeding complication on Pradaxa, we don't have any way of reversing the effect
reversing
of the medication.
It,
yeah, we don't.
Yeah.
So because of that, I prefer not to use it unless I have to. And so if somebody just can't tolerate the Coumadin or we can't control their blood on the Coumadin, then that's where I would go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Michael, thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. You know, the old drugs are still the best. Let's go to Sonia in Woodstock. Sonia, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello, it's you.
Yes, it's me. I'm just wondering if you can help me. About a year and a half ago, I had a bad fall, and I had a shoulder replacement. And ever since, I've had pain in my arms, so doesn't let up. I've tried all kind of stuff, and the doctor had been giving me pain medication for the pain, which put me to sleep. So I am in pain or I'm asleep, and this is not a way to live. I'm just wondering if there's anything else that can be done. The pain is not on top of the shoulder, because then now there is a plastic thing on top, but it's along the arm. It's a tendon or muscles or nerve or something.
Sonia, I'm sorry to interrupt. This really isn't the subject that we're going to today, but is this something that you have any opinion on, doctors? This is not really their specialty.
I mean, I can't tell you that I know how to fix the pain that you're suffering from, but your description sounds like there's a few possibilities. One is it's a nerve problem, either from the injury, from the fall, or from the neck, and so that should be explored with an MRI to make sure that that's not a cause. Unfortunately, the other possibility is the joints, the ligaments and muscles can all be very painful, especially after a major injury like that. And that may not be as easy to resolve. And then finally, there's kind of scarring from the nerves that also are difficult to treat. So I can't answer that question
Wrong side of the body. Are there other drugs possibly that might not put her to sleep?
Well, there are several medications that we use for neuropathic pain, that is pain that comes from nerves. A lot of them have the side effect of sedation. It's just, you know, natural side effect
too.
Of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes we're just stuck that way.
Okay. Sonia, sorry we couldn't help more.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you know what? This has been a fascinating hour. Do we have one more? Do we have? Okay, quickly. Who do we got up there? Diane from Goshen. Diane, you're the last one up. Got about a minute.
Yes.
Got about 1 minute.
Yeah, hi. You know, my husband had stroke-like symptoms, but he was told that what he had was transient global amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
I was never really comfortable with that. I was afraid that it was just, they couldn't figure out what it is, so that's what they called it. I never really understood what it is. Could you explain that to me?
Transient global amnesia is a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, less interesting for you probably than it is for me.
And by the way, you only have 30 seconds to do this. So
let me just quickly say, it is a syndrome where for a brief period of time, the brain is unable to lay down new memories. And for that period of time, the patient is really lost and will ask questions over and over again, trying to reorient themselves. What am I doing here? Why are we here? What's going on? But they don't lose memory for old things, you know, where they live, who they're married to, who their kids are, or anything like that. So I'm sorry, I can't get into more detail than that at this point.
Okay, well, that sounds like what he had. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. All right, doctors, this has been great. We really appreciate it. It was a good hour, great questions.
Absolutely.
Support for Vox Pop comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Also, thanks to Tiffany Brown-Bennett for answering the phones today and for having impeccable handwriting. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Shartok on Medical Monday. Stay tuned for the news.